It's Friday, July 10th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Greece submits economic reform proposals. South Carolina will remove the Confederate flag from its capital.
I'm very happy about it and think it's a good step forward.
New Yorkers welcome the Dalai Lama, and we look at a possible feud between two R&B stars. It's all ahead. The Greek Parliament is meeting Friday to decide whether to endorse reforms proposed to European finance ministers in exchange for more bailout money. Greece is reportedly promising to cut spending and raise taxes in the latest proposal for economic reforms submitted to the finance ministers. Reporter Henry Ridgewell in London has just returned from Athens and spoke with me about the crisis. What is this latest proposal that Greek officials have submitted?
Well, many analysts say it doesn't differ much from the proposals that were suggested by the European Union to Greece more than a week ago, and the same proposals that were rejected by the Greek people in a referendum on Sunday. And that really poses the difficulty for Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras, in that he's put the proposals to the Greek Parliament today. The Greek lawmakers will vote on them. Most people seem to expect that they will be approved, although many in the Greek media and many Greek politicians have picked up on the fact that these proposals are remarkably similar to what was put to the Greek people and was rejected to the Greek people. And indeed, some of the spending cuts that are detailed in the proposals go even further than the $9 billion that was suggested in the original plan. There are suggestions that the new spending cuts amount to around $12 billion. So, whether Alexis Tsipras has the democratic mandate really to take these proposals to Brussels on Sunday and debate them with European leaders remains a little uncertain. And if an agreement is made at the weekend, which might relieve Greece's immediate economic crisis, there's no guarantee that when he returns back home on Monday, that the people will accept what he has done over the weekend. So although there is optimism today over the Greek suggestions that were submitted yesterday, there is optimism that a deal will be done, markets have risen, Greece's borrowing costs have fallen slightly, there is still a lot of uncertainty and a lot of hurdles to be overcome.
Well, looking ahead to the meeting over the weekend, if this is approved and how European Union leaders will look at this, is it known, I know this is a bit speculative, that they will accept this?
There has been good noises, if you like, coming from Brussels, coming from especially Paris. The Parisian, the French finance minister, saying this was a serious and credible offer by Greece. A bit more muted response so far from Berlin, from Germany, which is, of course, the key nation, if you like, the hawk in these negotiations, which has demanded more cuts from Greece. They have said all along that they won't accept any so-called haircut on Greece's debt, i.e. a levelling down of the total amount they need or an extension of the period over which they must repay their debts. But today, with the proposal submitted, with the Greek Parliament due to vote on this, there is optimism among many EU officials that some kind of deal can be reached. Even Jerome Dijsselbloem, the head of the EU negotiations on this, has said that he thinks the Greek proposals are credible and that discussions will be had this weekend, which could lead to a deal. So we are further on from where we were a few days ago when there were major fears of an imminent Greek exit from the euro. There are still negotiations to be had and possibly sticking points over whether or not Greece's debt will be restructured. And that's a key one because that's a key demand of the Greek government. It's also a recommendation of the International Monetary Fund as well, but it's something that Berlin all along has said it won't accept. So we do need to see one side giving ground, and we're not sure which side that will be yet.
Thanks so much. That's Henry Ridgewell in London. South Carolina authorities are set to remove the Confederate flag from the grounds of the southern U.S. state capitol at a ceremony Friday. Governor Nikki Haley on Thursday signed a bill supported by Democrats and Republicans removing the Civil War-era flag 3 weeks after the racially inspired murders of 9 black church members. International Edition's Jeffrey Young spoke with Dr. Elsie Scott, the director of Howard University's Ron Walter Center.
South Carolina lawmakers have decided to take down the Confederate flag from state property. Dr. Scott, how does that hit you?
Well, first I say hallelujah. Secondly, I say it's about time, but I'm very happy about it and think it's a good step forward.
When we look at the Confederate flag, it's more than just a flag that represented a country that existed for 4 years and ended in 1865. There's a cultural and social subtext to this. Could you please explain that for VOA?
Growing up in the South, the Confederate flag to us meant hatred, racism. When people wanted to let you know that they hated you, they waved the flag in your face. When they wanted to discriminate against you, they put the flag up in their business. So it definitely has that meaning of not anything related to Civil War. You know, even those of us who grew up way after the Civil War, it was a symbol in the 60s of Jim Crow.
We saw in Charleston, South Carolina, just a short time ago, a terrible incident in which a young racist killed 9 people at an African-American church. There's been an awful lot of crying and healing since then. But with this flag, what can be healed? When can we put this thing away? When can we move forward? What's your perspective?
I'm a member of the AME Church, and I think we have the perspective that this is the first step. We are happy that the state of South Carolina has done what it has done. We're hoping that the other states will follow suit. But also, let's get to talking about how we got to where we are in terms of the racial divide, especially in the South. So we want to start by talking, and then we want to continue with action.
What does it take to reach across this divide? Is it possible for white Southerners and black Southerners to sit in the same place and shake hands? What does it take to cross this bridge?
I think it has already taken the death of 9 people, 9 innocent people in a church. And if that does not bring us to the table, I don't know what can. I hear the voice of Reverend Pinckney crying out from the grave, do something. And that's where, you know, I think a lot of my friends and my fellow members in the AME Church, that's what we feel like. He's guiding us to do more, and we're hoping that the white citizens will hear him.
Dr. Elsie Scott is at Howard University's Ron Walters Center.
And that's Jeffrey Young. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Palchevsky. So, Andrew, what's happening?
Well, you heard Dr. Scott use in that report, she said, it's about time. And that's the quote that we are seeing again and again on social media, people weighing in and saying it's about time that this flag comes down. So we're definitely going to see, as the flag comes down, a lot more opinion on social media. I wouldn't be surprised if we saw some people maybe taking photos from the scene and posting those. The other social media trending story that's come out of South Carolina is from State Representative Jenny Horn. She took to the floor of the South Carolina State House the other night and was fighting back tears, saying, I'm a descendant of Jefferson Davis, the Confederate president, and I think this flag should come down. It's a disgrace that this flag is up here. That video has gone viral. And she has since weighed out on social media. She tweeted out, she said, it wasn't easy, it wasn't without emotion, but I'm so proud of my colleagues for doing the right thing. The Confederate flag is coming down. So that's another trending story out of this, something she has become a name now associated with the story ever since this video has come out and spread throughout the internet. Another story we're seeing trending this morning is Go Set a Watchman. Now, it's a title of a book by Harper Lee. Harper Lee wrote To Kill a Mockingbird over 50 years ago, and has not written another novel since. Well, she's actually written a novel before To Kill a Mockingbird called Go Set a Watchman. The publisher said, well, we don't want to release this novel, write a different one. So she wrote To Kill a Mockingbird, sold over 30 million copies worldwide, a huge success. And now she's releasing the second book, Go Kill a Watchman. And what's interesting is that the first chapter of that book was published online today in The Guardian newspaper in the UK and The Wall Street Journal here in the US. So people sharing that on social media, weighing in, saying, I can't wait for the book to come out on July 14th. They're saying it's reportedly the most pre-ordered book since the Harry Potter series, and that was, of course, a huge success
as
well.
That's saying something, yeah.
Yes, so for sure this is going to be a huge release. But that's a trending topic this morning as people are starting to read that book and anticipating its release on Tuesday. And finally, we have the championships at Wimbledon. Going on this weekend, you're going to see some names trending on social media for sure. Today, Roger Federer plays Andy Murray. Novak Djokovic plays Richard Gasquet of France. And you're going to see a name this weekend, tomorrow. You're going to see Serena Williams, of course, the 20-time Grand Slam champion, but a name that you might not notice, Garbine Muguruza. She is 23 years old, and she's making her first appearance in a Grand Slam final from Spain. It's sure to be a good matchup. She actually beat Serena back in the French Open 2 years ago, so we'll see who prevails in that contest.
Very exciting. Thanks, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
An international team of scientists say that they recently found proof that there are a number of hidden supermassive black holes in the universe. Using NASA's Nuclear Spectroscopic Telescope Array, or NuSTAR, satellite observatory, the researchers detected high-energy X-rays from five supermassive black holes that had been blocked from direct view by dust and gas. The astronomers say that their findings back a theory that suggests the existence of possibly millions of these supermassive black holes throughout the universe that are hidden from view. The five previously hidden black holes also appear to be much brighter and more active than had been previously thought. The researchers admit that without the NuSTAR satellite observatory, it would have been nearly impossible to make the observations that uncovered the supermassive black holes. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, is there a possible feud between two R&B stars? We'll find out. The Dalai Lama is in New York City, where he's been celebrating his 80th birthday. The Tibetan spiritual leader appeared at the Javits Center Thursday, and there will be more ceremonies and festivities taking place today. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with me about the Dalai Lama's visit. Well, Adam, the Dalai Lama is visiting New York City, and how is the city commemorating his visit?
Well, there's the Javits Center here, which is a huge convention center where they have lots of international conventions and all kinds of things. They must seat, up to 8,000 or 9,000 people, usually commercial. But the whole center is filled with mostly Tibetan people, many of whom are in traditional dress, very, very colorful. You can tell the married women because they've got a certain kind of apron that they wear. And there's also kind of a festive atmosphere. Kids are running around. The PA system is not of the best, but I don't think people really mind that much. He's actually giving a very learned lecture on compassion and action in the world. He's well known as sort of a prince of peace and that kind of thing. He's got the Nobel Peace Prize, as you know. But he's also a great scholar, and he knows a lot about Buddhism, esoteric Buddhism, and explaining it to his followers, of whom there are many millions around the world.
Yes, he's certainly very popular in this country, and I believe began this visit in California.
Yeah, so I understand. Yes, he usually comes every year, usually about this time of year, and there's 2 days here. It happens to be his 80th birthday this week.
Are there any people there protesting his visit?
I have not seen any. I know that there has been a little bit of that lately. I've been getting emails and stuff like that as a reporter for people who say that he's sort of persecuting Buddhist minorities. I haven't seen any evidence either of the protesters or seen anything that he said that would indicate that he actually is doing persecution. But the short answer is no. I don't see any protesters around this site.
Adam, the Dalai Lama is in New York for 2 days, and there are going to be two events on the 2 days. What is the difference between the events on Thursday and Friday?
The event on Thursday is mostly kind of a religious spiritual thing. It's a scriptural-based lecture, basically, all day long that the Dalai Lama is given to the faithful. The lecture is given in Tibetan, you know, with all the regalia that's necessary. But it's really, I think, for Tibetans and people for whom this is a natural cultural home. I don't really follow him as kind of their leader. The other event is a gratitude ceremony for him. Basically, it's a celebration of his life. It coincides with his 80th birthday. And people are just happy that he's alive, happy that he's so inspiring. And they want to celebrate him in a good, wholesome way together in an extended community with lots of Americans and people coming from abroad just to appreciate the Dalai Lama and what he makes possible for them in their world, you know, according to their lights.
Okay, well, thanks very much, Adam.
You're welcome very much.
That's Adam Phillips in New York. Well, back at the Dalai Lama's exile home in northern India, Tibetans talked about what their spiritual leader means to them. Amy Yee reports from Dharamsala, India.
At a celebration of the Dalai Lama's 80th birthday in Dharamsala, Tibetan teenagers perform traditional songs and dance at the town's Buddhist temple. Music teacher Dawatashi led students in months of rehearsals. Tibetan music and dance is important for young exiles, he says.
To keep alive Tibetan culture and to pass for the younger generations what we have. And also the main thing is that by culture, we show our own identifications. People know this is Tibet. We make students to feel I'm a Tibetan.
The vibrant cultural display is one of the legacies of the Dalai Lama. He prioritized setting up Tibetan schools in India, where he has lived in exile since 1959. For the Dalai Lama, it has been a long journey from desperate escapee to world-renowned spiritual leader. Kelsang Damdul knows firsthand. The 89-year-old was head of the group of soldiers that guided the Dalai Lama out of Lhasa, the capital. Damdul says anxiety was so high, it was like the world was falling down. He says it was the saddest day because they had to leave their country, but there was nothing to be done. Today, Damdul lives in a retirement home in Dharamsala. About 12,000 Tibetans live in this hill town, with more than 100,000 spread across India. Lakpa Tsering was 13 when his family fled Tibet. Later, he became head of a Tibetan settlement in Mungud, in the southern Indian state of Karnataka. He remembers the Dalai Lama used to visit to check progress and encourage the dispirited refugees.
Even, you know, he used to, I remember he used to keep his hands in my shoulder, you know. We went into the cornfields and His Holiness, as I told you, as a sort of being a family, you know, head of the family, guides in everything.
Today, the Dalai Lama is known for his message of nonviolence, but tensions in Tibet continue after a Chinese crackdown that began in 2008. While the Dalai Lama's birthday is a joyous occasion around the world, many in Tibet could not freely celebrate the milestone. Amy Yee, VOA News, Dharamsala, India.
This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day, wherever the news may be. Our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
This is International Edition. A possible feud could be brewing between R&B stars Frank Ocean and Miguel. International Edition's David Byrd talks with VOA Soul Lounge host Shauna Reed about the quarrel.
There's an old proverb that says that as iron sharpens iron, so one man sharpens another. But when it's the music business and you say, hey, I make better music than you do, that's not exactly the same thing. But that's what's going on with Miguel and Frank Ocean. Shauna Renee joins us in the studio to talk about these two young men. First of all, let's give a little background here. This all kind of started when Frank Ocean won the Grammy and Miguel and Chris Brown didn't.
Right. This happened back in 2013. They were all up for the Best Urban Contemporary Album category. And Frank Ocean kind of came out of nowhere. At the time, Miguel was very popular. Of course, Chris Brown was hugely popular. So to have Frank Ocean win this award was very shocking, surprising, and obviously a bit upsetting for Miguel. Now, Frank Ocean got a standing ovation. Miguel would not stand. And that sort of began this rumor. It was the start of the rumor that perhaps there was something personal going on between these two men.
And then Miguel gave an interview in which he said, you know, frankly, I make better music than you do.
He did. He gave an interview with the Sunday Times recently, and he said, he was asked, he said, we're not friends. And to be completely honest, and I'm quoting now, and no disrespect to anyone, I genuinely believe that I make better music all the way around. We talk street art, sarcasm, crass humor in high fashion. Peach color moon glisses, the plot thickens as we laugh off of shotguns and tongue kisses. Bubble bath. And so this quote kind of took off and Twitter exploded. And it was like, oh, are these fighting words? Really? Are we now having beef and rivalries in R&B? Because this is something that traditionally is reserved for hip-hop music.
Right.
We never see it in R&B, and you especially don't see it in more contemporary R&B because it's just a different brand, a different feel. So everyone was a little concerned and confused, but then also excited about the fact that finally something's happening in this genre that is of interest. And Frank Ocean is working on a new project. Miguel has a new album out now, so it has piqued the interest of folks who may not have otherwise thought to check out either of these gentlemen.
And he was asked, Miguel was asked, if he had the chance to do it again, would you go back and give Frank Ocean the standing ovation? And he said no.
He said no. No, he said no.
Now, this is a little bit of talking smack. I mean, you know, this is okay if you're, you know, LeBron James or if you're in the NFL or, like, if you're in hip-hop.
Yeah.
You know, but most of the time when you're talking about guys that make this kind of music, it's all more kind of laid back and everybody's a little bit, you know, more relaxed, but apparently not. Apparently, there's a little bit of tension going on here.
Well, and hopefully it'll be good for both of them, because in hip hop, that's what the battles were about. The beef was about making sure that both artists stayed on top of their game, encouraging them to be better, to push boundaries. And both Miguel and Frank Ocean have already done that. So if they can use this to continue to expand the genre and their own careers, I think we'll all come out winners for it.
All right. So what do you think about this? You can let Shauna know by sending her a tweet at VOA Lady DJ on Twitter. She's also at VOA underscore music if you want to just reach everybody in the music department. You can also listen for Shauna in the Soul Lounge by logging on to our website, www.voanews.com.
That's our show. Have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United Nations has declared a humanitarian situation in war-torn Yemen a Level 3 emergency, the highest designation possible. According to the United Nations, more than 21.1 million people, over 80% of Yemen's population, are in need of aid, with 13 million facing food shortages and scarcity of other goods like fuel. Fuel and commercially imported food and medicine have been impacted severely by maritime interdiction operations, leading to scarcity of many resources. There are also reports of outbreaks of dengue fever and malaria that have already affected thousands of Yemenis. In addition, more than 3,000 people have been killed in the fighting. The military conflict in Yemen began in March when the Houthis took over large swaths of territory and forced the elected president, Abed Mansour Hadi, to flee the country. At the request of President Hadi, a Saudi Arabian-led military coalition began airstrikes against Houthi positions. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon and UN Special Envoy to Yemen Ismail Ould Sheikh Ahmed have been urging a humanitarian pause between the parties during the holy month of Ramadan, which ends on July 17th, so urgently needed aid can reach the Yemeni people. A previous five-day pause in May was repeatedly violated by the Houthis. The United States joins the United Nations and the international community in calling for an immediate humanitarian pause. In a written statement, State Department spokesperson John Kirby noted, "A pause, along with commensurate disengagement of armed forces in all areas, including Aden, Taiz, and Marib, would allow international aid organizations to deliver urgently needed food, medicine, and fuel to citizens throughout Yemen. It would also allow for the delivery of vital commercial goods on which Yemen depends." The United States, said spokesperson Kirby, will continue to work actively with humanitarian organizations to help facilitate the unimpeded delivery of humanitarian aid.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.